Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're plunging into a narrative that is so intense, so packed with political commentary and just gut-wrenching personal trauma that it really challenges every definition of a typical romance story.
It really does.
We're dissecting the relationship between these two characters, Anna and Chris, a journey that forces both of them to, well, to destroy their old worlds before they can find themselves or even each other again.
You know, what's immediately clear when you look at the source material is that if you classify this as just a love story, you're making a fundamental misunderstanding. It's just,
Rust.
It's not.
Not at all.
The romance is the engine, sure, but the actual cargo here is, I mean, it's national identity, economic disparity, ethical choice in the face of absolute corruption. This story is this really urgent narrative of self-actualization, and it's set against a backdrop of just deep sociopolitical dysfunction in the Philippines.
Absolutely. And we're not talking about, you know, minor disagreements or little misunderstandings here. The external pressures are monumental. You've got Chris, who is the entitled son of a powerful Philippine senator, swimming in what the text calls dirty money and political influence.
Right.
And then on the other side, you have Anna, who's fighting the daily grind of poverty, and she's facing down threats related to the NPA insurgency, the New People's Army, which, for listeners who might not be familiar, is a very often violent communist-led underground movement that really dictates life and politics in a lot of regions.
Precisely. And that breadth of themes, I mean, from the crippling grief over a mother's slow, avoidable death to the very real threat of political extortion and armed insurgents, that is what gives this narrative its quality and its staggering emotional intensity.
It doesn't pull any punches.
No, it doesn't flinch from showing how incredibly difficult it is to choose good and right when the entire system is actively designed to crush that choice. This isn't just, you know, some internal turmoil. It's a battle for survival in a broken context.
And the entire emotional scope of their journey, it's captured right there in Chris's opening metaphor. He describes love as a whirlwind.
Such a powerful image.
It is. Before it happens, you're unconnected, he says. You're like the leaves, worlds apart and all. Then suddenly, you're violently swept up, spinning like mad for a short span of time. But when you finally settle down, when the dust clears, you have this profound lasting memory of that moment when you were, if only for a few seconds, closer to the skies.
And that's what we're doing today.
Exactly. Our deep dive today is covering everything that happened before, during, and after that brief, destructive, and ultimately transformative whirlwind. Okay, so let's unpack the lives of Anna and Chris before that fateful summer. We see two incredibly damaged individuals whose coping mechanisms were perfectly opposed, yet somehow perfectly calibrated to eventually dismantle and rebuild one another.
A perfect opposition. That's a great way to put it. Let's start with Chris Trinidad. His entire life is just defined by this suffocating, corrupted sense of privilege.
Utterly suffocating.
He is the son of a powerful senator, a man who uses wealth and influence as both a shield and a weapon. Chris was miserable. He was forced into an economics program. He actually wanted business management, because his father wanted him primed for a future in law or politics. He wasn't a person, he was a vessel for his father's ambition.
And that defining mantra of his childhood, the one that just crippled his sense of responsibility, was his father's famous catchphrase, "It's all taken care of, Chris." And this wasn't, you know, paternal protection, it was surgical control.
Yeah.
The sources detail these horrifying examples of it. When Chris faced suspension for cheating in class,
it's taken care of.
Exactly. When he was involved in a drunken altercation at a party, ends up at the police station.
Taken care of. Even that destructive car accident with a prominent lawyer, the senator's influence just made the consequences vanish. Poof. Gone.
It's terrifying.
That phrase taught Chris that accountability was, well, it was optional for the wealthy. It fueled his arrogance, his anger, and his reliance on distraction. His coping mechanisms were classic rich kid rebellion, an expensive lifestyle, drinking Black Label whiskey, spending countless hours on his PlayStation.
And using women as a temporary pastime. That part is key.
Yes. And he had that staggering $500,000 summer allowance, which Chris himself knew was dirty money, likely siphoned off some local government project. He was just drowning in this guilt and cynicism, trying desperately to use material excess to plug a profound spiritual hole.
And that hole, it leads directly back to his deepest trauma, doesn't it? The death of his mother.
It all comes back to that.
He was only 8 years old when she was harassed and attacked by a gang of hoodlums on a train platform late one night in New York.
Yes. And this experience, it just fundamentally broke his belief in the power of good. Despite the senator having unlimited money, access to the best medical care in New York, Chris just watched his mother slowly die.
The language the source material uses is so visceral. It describes him standing by her bedside, watching her body mechanically heaving up and down with the life support machine,
pumping air into what he realized was essentially a corpse. I mean, can you imagine an 8-year-old processing that?
It's impossible. Yeah. And to witness that kind of utter helplessness, to see the absolute limits of his father's money and power when facing fate, facing biology, it led Chris to this terrifying conclusion about the world.
He just solidified his cynicism. He internalized the belief that, and this is a quote, good and right wasn't tolerated in the third world.
So his choices felt binary.
Completely binary. Either join the corrupt system and thrive, or be shot down and buried, or exported and lost overseas. That's the foundation. That is the angry, arrogant shell that Anna encounters that summer.
So now let's look at Anna. She is the complete opposite side of that coin. If Chris was suffocating from unwanted privilege, Anna was desperately fighting her way out of profound poverty and loneliness.
Exactly. She is the promdee, the girl from the province. And that term, it's used regionally to denote someone from a rural area, and it often carries the stigma of being, you know, poor or less sophisticated.
And her life was marked by loss, early and repeated loss. Her father, a shipman, died suddenly from a heart attack.
And then her aunt, who was her primary guardian, she died in a car accident.
So eventually, her mother felt she had to leave Anna alone in the city, prioritizing Anna's education over them being physically together. You can just feel that, creating this crippling fear of abandonment in her.
And her coping mechanism, unlike Chris's, which was all about destructive consumption, hers was extreme, almost pathological, overachievement, external validation.
She had dedicated herself entirely to academics, driven by this need to earn respect and build an escape route from her poor background. The force of her will is just, it's incredible when you see her accolades.
Oh, it is. Graduated magna cum laude from a prestigious university, served as class president, headed the debate team, collected awards until she was celebrated as Bangley's finest daughter. This external success was her carefully constructed armor.
But that armor, it was incredibly heavy, wasn't it? Despite all that success and validation, she confessed internally that she felt barely enough for myself.
Always running.
Constantly guarding against failure, constantly afraid that if she stopped running, the life she had built would just instantly collapse.
And this is where her faith becomes so central to her character. It's not just a background detail. Because she was so often physically alone, her internal life was guided by this profound, constant relationship with Papa God, who she called her dearest friend.
It's such a personal, intimate name for God. Dearest friend.
It is. Her extensive prayer life and her faith, they became her only source of real strength to navigate that constant loneliness and her debilitating fear of failure. She wasn't just, you know, performing for God. She genuinely relied on him to survive. So when Chris, with all his destructive cynicism, barrels into her life, he meets this impenetrable fortress, a fortress built on textbooks, accolades, and a very fervent faith.
Which brings us right to the core of the narrative. Their interactions during that intense summer.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Their initial dynamic was never romantic. Not really. It was a psychological battle.
A battle of wills from the very start.
Absolutely. Chris saw Anna, this local village heartthrob, as just a temporary pastime for his summer boredom. A distraction.
Meanwhile, Anna, she saw Chris as the perfect target for all her repressed anger toward the corrupt system that had oppressed her family for generations. She saw him as a symbol.
A symbol she could break. She goes into that relationship with the intent to teach him a lesson. She literally thinks to herself, let's see who breaks whose heart, Chris.
So she immediately positions the romance as a contest, a power struggle. She's determined to challenge his privilege and maintain absolute control over the emotional outcome.
And their first date in Pagudpud, it perfectly establishes this antagonistic pattern. It's not flirting. It's high-level verbal sparring.
She immediately mocks his reliance on his status, right? She points to his car and says, your car says Senate, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That'll get you far. It's just dripping with contempt.
And Chris, you know, he's trying to bridge this gap, but all he can manage is to call her a full of herself campus heartthrob. They are just talking directly at each other's deepest vulnerabilities from the word go.
That antagonism, it just escalates until it reaches its absolute apex in that devastating gazebo confrontation. Anna, frustrated by Chris's deep-seated cynicism of the country and his passive acceptance of his privileged life, decides to go for, complete destruction.
She weaponizes everything. Everything she knows about his family. She doesn't just accuse, she uses specific damaging numbers that she's gleaned from her own political awareness.
She digs into his cut from his father's corrupt projects, shouting, "It was actually 30%, wasn't it?" She's not guessing. She's stating a fact she's researched.
And she publicly labels his family thieves who enriched yourselves at the expense of the Filipino people and calls them a malignant tumor in the nation's body politic. Just brutal.
And crucially, she uses Chris's own words against him.
Yeah.
He'd previously dismissed the country as pathetic. She throws that word right back in his face, forcing him to own his self-hatred.
And then she delivers the killing blow.
She calls him broken.
And that's it. That total assault on his identity, his family, his privilege, his country, and his core self, it triggers the total collapse of his cynical armor. This is when he finally confesses the gut-wrenching details of his mother's attack and agonizing death. All the pretenses just destroyed. They're left with two raw, exposed souls.
It's such a necessary, even if it is a cruel moment of destruction. But the true symbolism of their transition, right? The moment where the healing actually begins, it's not in the violence of the gazebo. It's in the quiet, shared labor of the kitchen scene.
Yes. That scene is so pivotal, and it's so quiet compared to the gazebo. It's a profound shift. Anna pushes Chris too far during this trivial argument over doing the dishes.
Just normal everyday argument.
Exactly. And Chris, in a flash of that inherited Trinidad rage, he slams a plate onto the counter and it just shatters everywhere. Now, this could have easily escalated into another destructive fight. It could have cemented Chris's expectation that anger and violence solve everything.
But that's not what happened.
Not at all. Instead of retaliating, instead of shouting or running away, Chris just stops arguing. He completely deflates. He quietly gets on his knees and begins picking up the broken ceramic pieces.
And that simple, silent act, it symbolizes the utter wreckage of his old, cynical, angry world. And it breaks through Anna's final layer of defensiveness.
Hmm.
She realizes in that moment that she was just as cruel as he was cynical.
And the key line is that she joins him. She sees her own cruelty, her own guilt, and she says, "I got on my knees and helped him." That moment, picking up the shattered plate together, that is the physical manifestation of their partnership.
They're acknowledging their old worlds are destroyed.
And that the only way forward is through shared, silent labor. They're starting to rebuild each other's lives, piece by broken piece, right there on the kitchen floor.
The transformation in Chris after that is remarkably swift. He immediately responds to Anna's subtle guidance. He quits smoking, and he's so proud, he brags to her that he's been smoke-free for almost 1 week.
It's like a little kid. It's so endearing. And he begins shedding the oppressive weight of his rich kid mentality. He starts actively rejecting his VIP status in favor of genuine community engagement.
This is when Anna starts teaching him what the text calls the trench work.
Yes, a complete philosophical shift for him. She shows him local life, instructing him to stop, go in, and know their stories.
She highlights these local heroes who thrive through honest work,
yeah,
despite these crushing economic odds. People like Manong Ariel.
Right, Manong Ariel, the tricycle driver who supports 5 children on just $500 a day, which, for our listeners, is roughly equivalent to less than $10 US a day.
And yet, Manong Ariel's children are now successful, working abroad. It shows Chris that integrity and hard work can still yield fruit, even in the deepest poverty.
And then, most critically, there is the story of Manong Aring, the elderly woman who owned Memories Today, the rundown eatery where they first met.
Her store was built on a minuscule 10,000 microloan after her husband died. And Anna refers to this small, humble loan as Manong Aring's God's little mustard seed.
And this is such a crucial analytical moment. Chris, who was just given a $500,000 allowance that was dirty money, is suddenly confronted with the immense power of 10,000 of honest, faith-driven capital.
It completely reorients his entire worldview.
It gives him a concrete, humble purpose. He realizes he can use his immense energy and connections for good. He chooses to become a trench worker, someone who focuses on the grassroots, instead of remaining an executive summary rich kid who's only concerned with the bottom line.
This whole foundational period culminates in that emotional peak when Chris gives Anna his deepest, most vulnerable confession back in the gazebo, the site of their previous destructive fight.
A full circle moment.
It is. And she provides him with the validation he's been starved of his entire life. She calls him her best friend and, significantly, a guiding light, recognizing the inherently good person that was buried beneath that cynical exterior.
They managed to build this incredible, life-altering foundation in just 10 days. It's astonishing. But their connection, however deep, was ultimately fragile.
And the external threats, combined with Anna's own deep-seated fears, brought the summer romance to a sudden, painful, and very misunderstood end.
We have to first acknowledge that external threat, which is personified by Michael, he is far, far more than just a jealous ex.
Not even close. The sources confirm he is a dangerous NPA insurgent running a communist grid in Ilocos. He's engaged in recruitment and armed propaganda.
So for Anna, just associating with Chris, the son of a high-profile, politically corrupt senator, was literally putting both their lives in the crosshairs.
And Michael uses high-stakes political leverage. Anna had previously confessed that her mother had these complex business arrangements that Michael was now using for extortion.
He saw Anna as a traitor for being with the enemy's son, and so he executes a targeted, violent attack. He and his group severely beat Chris. And crucially, this wasn't just a physical brawl. They specifically focused on one thing.
Stealing and destroying Chris's cell phone.
That one action. The destruction of the phone. That is the ultimate source of their separation and misunderstanding. It cuts off all digital communication, ensuring that Chris, once he leaves the province, cannot contact Anna.
Which leads him to believe she just abandoned him, ghosted him.
Exactly. And this leads directly to Anna's critical self-implosion. This is the moment where her own agency, driven by fear, takes over.
After seeing Chris beaten, she experiences what the text calls a dark night of the soul.
She realizes that she, the campus queen, the model student, is actually a lightning rod for trouble. She concludes that loving Chris could destroy everything she's built and could potentially harm her mother through Michael's threats.
Her fear of abandonment, which is rooted in her lonely childhood, ironically leads her to proactively abandon the person she loves.
It's a tragic paradox. In a drunken state on their final night, she emotionally and physically pushes Chris away. She cruelly calls him useless, insisting she must face this alone.
And then she gives him the freedom she knows he needs to survive by shouting, "You are going to leave me."
It's a profound act of self-sabotage, but it's rooted in this perverse form of protection. She trashes the sincere love that's being offered to her precisely because she fears it will inevitably be taken away, just like her father, her aunt, and her mother were.
So her final choice is this heartbreaking exercise in agency. She leaves Chris a note urging him to fearlessly and truly live based on the humility and purpose he found in Ilocos.
While she remains behind to confront the wreckage alone, realizing her own fear and doubt had ultimately destroyed everything around her.
That sudden, painful breakup, it set them both on these parallel, incredibly difficult paths for the next several years. The period after the whirlwind required a complete, years-long realignment for both of them.
For Anna, the struggle began the second she returned home. Her friend, Manong Delphin, the tricycle driver, actually refused her a ride because of specific NPA threats against her.
She's already an outcast in her own community.
Immediately. Then she finds her small store, Easy Purchase, completely destroyed, shelves toppled, glass broken, walls scorched. Total devastation.
And what's fascinating is her response to that. She doesn't just blame Michael. She accepts that she destroyed it through her own fear and self-doubt. That realization is the start of her journey away from needing external validation.
But her darkest night deepens immediately after she and her mother flee in Manila. Her mother falls critically ill with cancer.
And Anna, dedicated to easing her mother's pain, accrues this astronomical amount of debt, over $4 million. Which, just for context, in that local economy, that amount of debt is absolutely crippling. It's not just a monetary failure. It's a burden that can take generations to repay.
She felt absolute helplessness. All her magna cum laude achievements, all her academic skills couldn't help her family. Her job helping the less privileged seemed meaningless when she couldn't save her own mother.
And this is where her faith takes over completely.
She moves away from relying on her own strength and she leans wholly on Papa God, her dearest friend. She has this realization that he always believed in her, even when she stopped believing in herself during this period of devastation. Her faith guides her away from seeking the accolades she once craved, towards a new, simpler purpose rooted in devotion.
And that purpose is cemented by the definitive turning point, discovering she is pregnant with Chris's child.
Yes. During her first ultrasound, the doctor shows her the baby's perfectly beating heart on the screen.
And the source material describes this so beautifully. Anna sees the child, Julius, as a beautiful miracle, a physical manifestation of the love she had sabotaged.
This child provides her with a new, simple identity. She matters because she is everything to him. She swears she will walk hell and high water just for him, and that shifts her identity from the fragile campus queen driven by fear to the unwavering, devoted single mother driven by unconditional love.
Meanwhile, Chris was undergoing his own necessary quiet transformation. Upon leaving the province, he was just shattered.
Utterly. The sources reveal this moment of profound vulnerability where he breaks down, sobbing on the shoulder of his driver, Timo, completely unable to face his father.
And this is where Timo, who was just sort of in the background before he steps out, Chris learns that Timo, who is often just a driver, was this deeply caring figure who knew Chris's mother from the old days.
Timo provides the comfort and validation he needs. He becomes this necessary, simple mentor who guides Chris through his initial trauma.
So Chris returns to Manila, and he executes a complete career pivot. He follows the calling Anna helped him discover. He becomes the trench worker.
He rejects his father's pre-law political destiny and leaves the family law firm entirely, no looking back.
And his new beginnings are intentionally humble and simple. It's a direct philosophical rejection of his father's complicated, corrupt business dealings. He starts with ice and rice sales.
Because, as he put it, it sells. I profit. It's simple. The simplicity is the antidote to the corruption he grew up in.
But he utilizes his inherited shrewdness for good. He expands his efforts by strategically acquiring a profitable flake ice franchise, placing the distribution points in high traffic, often government-affiliated offices.
He's still using his connections, yes, but he is subverting the corrupt structure.
Right. Think about the structural implications of that. He is using his family's influence to secure contracts, but for an honest, legitimate, highly simple commodity ice, not for inflated construction projects or corrupt consulting fees.
He is fulfilling his mother's dream of building up the country through honest work, starting from the ground up, the trench level. He fundamentally rejects the executive summary bottom line only mindset of his father's world.
He's now super hands-on. He cares deeply about the people in the trenches, even offering vendors new cell phones and taking care of their expenses. He is the man Anna influenced him to be.
He's echoing the lesson of Manang Aring's mustard seed.
Exactly. And so years pass, and they're eventually led back together, both changed, yet still carrying the scars of that summer and the lingering, painful misunderstanding of Michael's actions.
But before their final convergence, Chris handles one important piece of personal cleanup. He seeks out Cher, his old girlfriend.
Oh, that's right.
And he offers a genuine apology for cheating and leaving her that summer. He realizes she deserved far better, which just shows his maturity and his commitment to honest closure.
Their ultimate inevitable intersection happens at a wedding reception at St. Augustine, and they both arrive tethered to new commitments. Chris is engaged to Lisa.
Though that relationship is already strained, Lisa found his simple ice and rice business dicey, which just highlights the societal expectations he's rejected.
And Anna is wearing a ring, accompanied by her young son, Julius.
The tension is immense. Chris, no longer arrogant, he proudly shares his trench work, his flake ice franchise in government buildings, with Anna, who validates his success. She acknowledges his smart strategy.
But Anna's being flirtatious, which confuses him, and she's still withholding the full truth about her life and her son.
And the required closure, that moment where the truth must completely explode, it comes to a head later in the Park Chapel. Chris, blindsided by her reappearance, her flirtation, her continued secrecy, he just lashes out in profound anger and betrayal.
He unleashes years of hurt. He accuses her of using him as a doormat, only to fly off to New York for her dream job and leave him to deal with the wreckage she created. He feels she betrayed the very foundation they built that summer.
And this time, Anna, pushed to the brink, she refuses to self-implode. She finally exerts her agency for truth. She reveals the facts that explain his abandonment.
She tells him about the phone.
And then the ultimate bombshell, the revelation that completely transforms Chris's future. Who is Julius? He is your son too, Chris.
And the sources confirm the beautiful literary reference here. She names him Julius after the novel Julius Caesar she was reading that summer, tying the child's identity directly to their brief, intense romance.
Chris is just stupefied. He has to confront the fact that he has a son, but his reaction isn't one of doubt, it's one of confirmation.
He pulls out the final physical proof of his enduring devotion, the tiny seashell Anna gave him that summer. He's kept it all these years.
And he confirms to her that those 10 days, despite all the pain, were the best thing that ever happened to me. This just breaks the final barrier of doubt between them.
With the misunderstanding gone and their foundation reaffirmed, Anna finds her ultimate closure. She states, I believe in God, and I will always believe in you too, Chris.
And that statement is the culmination of her entire journey, moving from a faith based on fear of failure to a faith based on unconditional belief in her dearest friend and, crucially, in the man she loves.
The story then concludes on this hopeful yet open-ended note, which demonstrates Anna's immense maturity. She tells Chris she must still leave for New York due to irreversible commitments.
She is no longer running from a challenge. She is fulfilling a duty rooted in her new devoted purpose.
And Chris, the transformed man, gives her his final anchor-like assurance. He tells her he will wait. He instructs her, wherever you have to go, whatever you have to do, don't think twice and just do it. Now, once you start missing me so much, I'll just be right here.
The whirlwind has finally settled, and he is her solid, trench-working anchor in the world. And we get the final, profound piece of wisdom from the narrative through their son, Julius.
Right.
Daddy is just on Earth.
That line is just absolutely beautiful, because it transcends all the immediate logistical and geographical boundaries separating them. New York versus Manila, UN work versus ice carts. Chris is just on Earth now, doing his humble work, waiting patiently.
But Julius's innocent perspective sets this encouraging, hopeful tone for a complete family reunion that feels like an inevitable, maybe even divine promise.
The whirlwind was destructive, but the memory, just as Chris predicted, carried the ultimate weight of transformation. So if we revisit our initial question, was this just a love story?
Absolutely not. It was a narrative of self-actualization. The love story served as this brutal, necessary mirror, forcing both characters to destroy their old, broken worlds. Chris's world of cynical, entitled privilege.
And Anna's world of defensive, fear-driven achievement.
So they could build new, honest lives focused on humility, honesty, and genuine purpose.
The emotional intensity, the quality, and the sheer depth of this narrative comes from the raw portrayal of personal trauma and the devastating difficulty of choosing good and right in a system plagued by insurgency and political corruption. Their journey confirms that profound personal transformation is possible.
But it requires that you acknowledge your own shattered pieces and, crucially, find someone who is willing to get on their knees and help you pick them up.
Perfect summary.